said, I've visibly and I've truly shown that. How many of you prayed more than you usually do? 74%. I don't know if some of you who are there, the next couple weeks in our church, we were still down in the teen bay, okay? Those Sundays, and those of you who have not been in the teen bay, you won't totally understand what I'm saying because it has about half the space that this room does. That Sunday in our two services, we squeezed 700 people in there. Now, the third Sunday after that, guess what happened? Back to normal. One of the things that we teach companies when we go in to work with them is try to help them understand how to operate in crisis. Because statistics show that companies are much more effective and efficient when they're operating in a crisis mode. And so we go in, and part of what we do in our consulting is we help them to simulate the crisis and to put in situations and put in conditions in which they can more aptly work under those conditions. Why? Because statistics tell us that they will be more efficient and more effective. And it works. It works in companies. But you know what? It's incredibly difficult to make it work in the life of an individual. You see, if we were all living in a way, in a crisis mode, even if we think about, can I simulate a crisis here? Can I live? Why is it that we can, fill up the church, we can double our attendance when a crisis hits, but you know what? Then in a very relatively short period of time, things go back to normal. Why is it? We are a people of normal. We are a people, when you get down to it, where our default setting is to settle for mediocrity. You and me both. I'm no different. I mean, if I don't stay on top of things, mediocrity is where I'm going to move back to. Just kind of doing my thing, just kind of being average. You got to work not to be average. You see, I don't think Jesus ever intended for any of his Christ followers to be average. And here's what you and I do, and we talk about this a lot. We compare ourselves when we try to figure out if we're doing well or not. A lot of times we'll compare ourselves to who? Other people. When we got to focus on God's standards and not that of other people. Well, today, as we open this series, and we're going to talk about pregame preparation, pregame prep. That's what we're talking about today. I imagine right now that the Panthers are probably in some film sessions, some strategy sessions. The coaches are maybe they're in their chapel services. They have a very active level of participation with regard to that. But they're in a lot of things right now. But you know what? They've been preparing for this day for a long time to play the Eagles, And so they're prepping. They have been prepping. And the big day is almost here. Well, you know what? Our prep, a big part of our prep for our life is our prayer life. It's our ability and our willingness to pray, to say, God, what is it that you want me to do? How is it that I can serve you? Show me this. Show me that. Give me wisdom. Give me favor. Help me understand the people that are around me. Protect them. Protect my family. Give them favor. Give me the opportunities. Give me the challenges. Now, I want to look at Nehemiah's pregame prep for a minute. Because I believe that his life demonstrated something to us that we need to think about sometimes. Every appliance that ever works typically runs off some source of power, right? Right? You plug it in a wall, maybe it runs by battery, whatever the case might be. There are other means of power, I'm sure. But, there's some source of power. Your source of power has to be your relationship with Christ. And it has to be in terms of how to get that power and to keep it going. A lot of it has to do with your prayer life. So I want us to take a look about four or five principles today with regard to this guy, Nehemiah. And these principles, I think, are going to be very important for us to really understand how these things can work for us. Now, Nehemiah was a guy who lived in the 400 BC time frame, okay? And he was a guy who had been exiled. Actually, his family had been exiled in around 605 B.C. Now, keep in mind, B.C. time was descending. 605 happened before 445. You got that? Okay. And so in 605 B.C., all the Jews were carried away to Babylon under the reign of this guy named Nebuchadnezzar. All right, we studied him about him and Daniel a couple of summers ago. All right, we've looked at him a few times. And so Nehemiah found his way, and his regimes changed from the Babylonian Empire to the Medo-Persian Empire. Things shifted. And now, under the rule of this king named Artaxerxes, Jews like Nehemiah were able to move into important positions because there was a lot of favor. After there was a 70-year captivity, just real quick, it's beyond the scope of this message today. God had prescribed a 70-year captivity. Some Jews went back to Babylon, but a lot of them stayed, all right, where they were from Babylon. We went back from Babylon to Jerusalem. But some stayed there in Babylon. And so he had worked his way into a position of being the king's, Artaxerxes, cupbearer. All right, now cupbearer is what? It's the taste tester. All right, it's the person that tastes everything to make sure that if somebody's trying to poison the king, the cupbearer takes the bullet, literally, for the king, you know. And so if he didn't get sick, well, the king thinks, well, it's okay to go ahead and eat food. So that's his position. Well, we see him, he gets word from his brother named Hanani, who was one of those back in Jerusalem. And he said, and he came from Judah, and he questioned him. Because now keep in mind, Hanani was back in Judah. He goes back to visit brother Nehemiah in Babylon, and he gives him a report about what's going on. And he finds that even though Nehemiah had never been there, Nehemiah had this idea of what Jerusalem had been in its glory days. All right? And he knew that it had been a magnificent place. Well, Hanani came back with firsthand account of what was going on there. Everything was decrepit. It was ruined. There was the land was in its same beaten down, broken down, walls destroyed, buildings destroyed state. Not much progress had been made. And so we see in verse 3 of chapter 1, they said to me that those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire. He says, when I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and I fasted and I prayed before the God of heaven. So, I want to move into the next part there and give you the first of Nehemiah's prayer principles. And that is the principle of boldness. Boldness. The first principle of Nehemiah's prayer life is that of boldness. Because I want you to look at how he approaches God. All right, He's beaten down. He's burdened over the situation. He says, O Lord, God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love and those who love him and obey with those who love and obey his commands. Let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you today. Today and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's house, have committed against you. Pretty bold, right? Now, first of all, what he did in the end there, he confessed his sins. He said, God, I've sinned against you, so have my people. All right? All of us have. And we got to acknowledge that. You can hold me accountable for that, he said, if you want to. But he said, Lord, hear me. He's kind of demanding, don't you think? Kind of demanding. He approaches God with boldness. Why? Because his heart is broken. In Hebrews chapter 4, many of us have heard this verse before. The writer says, let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. You know what the key to boldness is? Confidence. It's confidence that God's going to do what he says he's going to do. You know why I think a lot of people don't pray? Even those who profess to be Christ followers. They don't have a regular, steady prayer life. They don't think God's going to do anything. Their faith is so small. They don't believe God. They don't think God's going to do anything. To them, it's a platitude. It's one of the reasons that Billy Graham one time was quoted as saying, the biggest mission field in the world is the church. Because he recognizes that maybe 70 to 90% of the people that he speaks to when he was ever in church, you know, people come for crusades from churches and that kind of thing, are probably really not Christ followers. Now, they profess to be Christ followers. Okay, now that's a scary proposition. That's an incredibly scary proposition. But if Billy Graham said it, there's probably some truth to it. And what if that were the case? that 70 to 90% of the people that regularly sit in church and claim to be Christ followers really weren't. Because when you get down to the core of it, for example, they really don't believe, they don't have the confidence that God's going to do what He says He's going to do. Kind of sobering, isn't it? Really sobering to think about it. So I ask you the question, do you have confidence that God's really going to do what He says He's going to do? Do you have a confidence enough to make time in your day to pray? Now, don't get stereotypical about what prayer life is. A lot of people think, well, I've got to put on this robe and I've got to go into this separate part of my home and I've got to stay there for 5 hours and do that. No. The biggest chunk of my day that I spent praying, you know what it is? It's in the morning, early, when everybody gets up, or nobody gets up, anybody else gets up. And you know what? It's while I'm working out on my elliptical. That is the most peaceful time of my day. It is the time when I can get away, when I can focus, and it's when I can spend the time praying. Now, there's other times too, okay? Remember, prayer is a regular thing that goes on during the day. But I encourage you to find a chunk of time. Now, some people are going to say, well, Bud, you can't really do two things at one time like that. You're being distracted. No, you can say that, and I'll respect your opinion, okay? But I'll respectfully disagree, all right? Now, I wouldn't advise saying my biggest chunk of time is while I'm driving on the way, because you got to look out for other things. I can close my eyes, you know, and just kind of focus and just go, okay? So you got to be reasonable in that. But find a big chunk of your day or a significant chunk of time where you can have a major prayer time and let everything else just kind of flow out of that during the rest of the day. Does that kind of make sense? Because a lot of people say, well, I can't really do what you're talking about, Bud. I just don't have the time. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Yeah, you can make time. And you know what? Convert something you're already doing. All right? Think of what it is. God didn't mind that. God didn't mind that. All right, here's, the next principle of expectation of prayer, of his prayer principle, is kind of illustrated by a story that Todd Felkel told me about him before he met Christy. All right? And here's how the story went. I wrote it down. And he said he bought a bright green shirt one day, and it had big purple polka dots on it. Inside the pocket, the first time he put it on, he found a note with a girl's name and address and a request that the buyer of the shirt send a picture of himself. Now, this was the girl who had put it together, the factory, okay? And he thought, so Todd thought, well, you know, what have I got to lose? Potential for romance here. So Todd puts a picture of himself along with a note, and he sends it in an envelope to the gal, right? Well, he thought, well, you know, I probably won't hear anything back from them, you know. But he got a letter back a few weeks later. And he anxiously opened the envelope and found a note from the sewing machine operator at the shirt factory. It said, thanks for the picture. I was just curious to see what kind of guy would buy this kind of shirt, you know. His sense of expectancy, of expectation was dashed, you know, his hopes for romance until Christy came along and rescued him from the bleak, dark life that he lived up until that point. So expectancy is the second principle of prayer that we need to have in our lives. We need to expect something good to come of this. You know, we need to expect God to do something. Now, we all know, well, most of us know, that, and I kind of believe that the sayings that God gives one of three answers, yes, no, and wait, yeah. But we've got to expect Him to do something. We see that in verse 11. We're going to go there in a minute. You know, when I was out there, I had to go to San Francisco this past week, or the last couple of days of the week, and I was taking the red eye back on Friday night. My flight actually left at 11:55 Pacific time Friday night. And so I had about 7 hours in there. So I checked the Giants baseball schedule. They were playing the Dodgers. So I said, well, I'm going to go to the Dodgers and Giants game. And what I really noticed, I got to walk out, you know, before the park. And if you've seen the Giants, you know that the stadium's right on the San Francisco Bay, right? And out in right field, you've got what they call McCovey Cove, named for one of their big-time sluggers, Willie McCovey, who was really big when I was a kid. Just a big-time home run hitter, left-handed hitter. He would knock balls out in the old Candlestick Park out that way all the time, out of the park. And now, if you hit it out of the park out there, it's going to splash down in the bay, right? So what have they got out there? I got to see the guys who were out there in the canoes, right? They're floating around with their paddles the whole game. Now, they're not seeing the game. All right, now they might have little battery-operated TVs out there or something, but they're waiting for someone to hit a home run and to fall into McCovey Cove, and they go to get the ball. That's what they do. And I was absolutely amazed by their sense of expectancy. I was thinking, my goodness, the patience that those guys show. Would I do that? Absolutely not. No. But they did that. They had this sense of expectancy that was huge. So Nehemiah prays in verse 11, "Grant me success now as I go to ask the king for a great favor. Put it in his heart to be kind to me." Nehemiah was thinking ahead. God, here's what I need you to do. Put it in his heart to be kind to me. As unlikely as it may be, I want you to do it. Jesus said in Matthew 21, "If you believe, you will receive whatever you ask for in prayer." What do you expect when you pray? What do you expect when you pray? What do you expect when you pray? Well, there's the third principle that is really big, and I call it the principle of spontaneity. It's this principle of spontaneity. And we see that here in a few verses later, in beginning in chapter 2. And spontaneous means happening or arising without apparent external cause. It's self-generated. It arises from a natural inclination or an impulse and not from external incitement or constraint. It's just something that happens. Prayer should be something in our lives. It's just something that happens. And we see that over in Nehemiah. Rick, what are you doing?
I'm your visual aid.
For what?
Spontaneity.
Spontaneity.
I'm being spontaneous.
Yeah, you are being spontaneous.
I'm being spontaneous.
Well, why do you have to be spontaneous in a football uniform?
I knew you were going to ask that.
Yeah, the question I've got to ask is, why is it that I'm seeing posters around here of Mike Ward when he played in high school, okay?
Yeah.
Of Todd Felkel when he played in college. And Rick, you've been in a football uniform.
Yeah. It's my uniform.
Williams.
This is mine. I play for Williams.
Rick, you grew up in California.
Part of my life. And the part that I was in California, it was a long commute. A very long commute.
To go to Williams, high school.
To do Williams.
And to play football.
They flew me in.
Pretty long flight.
I know what y'all are laughing about. It's true.
Well, okay. So that explains why we've got a picture of Mike Ward in high school, a picture of Todd Felkel in college, and you looking, actually, Rick, very much like you do today.
Yeah.
If that's your high school picture.
Yeah, that's my high school picture. Yeah. I don't wear glasses back then.
Yeah, you didn't have glasses, but you had the same kind of goatee kind of thing going on there.
Yeah, I was working it then.
Your hair was receding a little bit?
A little bit. It was premature.
Yeah?
Premature.
Yeah. Okay. Was that your phone? Didn't turn your cell phone on silence?
It was my phone. It was my phone.
What's your phone doing on? Do you think you need to answer it or anything?
No, I don't need to answer it. I know who it is.
Yeah? Well, who is it?
It's football coach at Williams.
Well, Sunday, they play on Fridays.
They play on Fridays, yeah, apparently.
So why would he be calling you?
They wanted the football uniform back.
And you didn't get it back to him?
No. No, it turns out Joni really likes me in the uniform.
But Rick, you're missing a particular part. You've got the top, you got the shoulder pads, you got the jersey, but I don't know that those were your regular pants.
They are. These ones. Turns out the bottoms don't fit as good.
And so you played football now, and I guess she probably did back then.
She really likes the pads, bud.
Okay, Rick. You know, you've done a really good job of helping me explain spontaneity today.
All right, that's all I'm here for, bud. I'm here to help you out.
You've done that, Rick. You can go now. Thank you. I appreciate it, Rick. Rick. So let's get back to Nehemiah, okay? Spontaneity is best illustrated when we see in the first of the second chapter, he's ready. He knows he's been praying now for 4 months about this deal. And he knows at some point he's going to have to make a request to the king, because Nehemiah knows that he's going to need to go back there in Jerusalem and do something about this. But he can't get out of his service. Why? Because he's a very trusted member of the king's court. And it's not like he can just leave. And so he's, you know, 4 months he prays, he fasts during that time, and all of a sudden, he gets a question. And it's beginning of chapter 2, if you go there with me, we see this happens in the month of Nisan. No, that's not a car back then. It was actually the word on the Roman Jewish calendar, what was used, that indicated the month of April. All right. And so here around the month of April, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought from here for him, I took the wine and I gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before. I'd always been cheerful, because you know what would happen if you were in the king's service and you ever came to him with anything less than a cheerful mind and, you know, your spirit looking good, you could be subject to like losing your head. OK, that was very incredibly important. Everybody was to, you know, just looks so, you know, everything is wonderful, hunky-dory, etc. And so the king asks him, why does your face look so sad when you were not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. He says, I was very much afraid. Why? Because it had been found out. But what really was happening was this. God was providing an opportunity for spontaneity on the part of Nehemiah. Look at next what happens. I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? The king said to me, what is it you want? Then I prayed to the God of heaven and I answered the king. You see what happened here? God provided a moment that Nehemiah was not expecting. Nehemiah would then go and he would do what he'd been waiting 4 months for the opportunity to do. To talk to the king about the situation at Jerusalem. And you know what? He took advantage of the moment. He stepped into the moment. He asked the king, and the king ultimately would allow him to go. To lead a convoy back and to begin the rebuilding of the town. There was great risk here. He was afraid. Ephesians 6:18 says, pray at all times and on every occasion in the power of the Holy Spirit. Stay alert and persistent in your prayers for all Christians everywhere. A lifestyle. Pray at all times. Look for the opportunities for spontaneity. Nehemiah prayed, you know, before. Now, here's what I like what he did. Even as God gave him this opportunity, he prayed right before he spoke to the king. Okay, and here, you know, God, give me wisdom. Help me to know what to say. It can be as simple as that. You see, prayer is to be conversational. It's not supposed to be filled with big words, you know? So often, you go to places and you hear people pray sometimes, and they, you know, it's kind of like they're, you know, go on and on and on. Some churches you go to and the pastoral prayer is kind of like they're trying to catch up on their quiet time, you know. Goes on and on and on, these big words. God is a conversational God. He's a conversational God. Well, after I'd left Glen Hope to start Integrity, I was really kind of honored one day when a family called me to the bedside of a lady who was quite ill. And as I went up the walk, I met the little daughter, who, matter of fact, had been in my youth group, and said, I'm very glad your mother remembered me in her illness. Is the guy who had, our senior pastor, you know, I said, well, is he out of town this week? And no, she said, no, he's at home, but we thought it might be something contagious, and we didn't want to expose him to it, so we called you. You know. That illustrates for us the fourth element or the fourth principle of prayer, and that's the principle of risk. If you're going to have a prayer life, you better be ready for risk. Because if you're going to have a prayer life, inherent is going to be this risk element. You got to be ready, because if you're going to be a Christ follower, your life is going to be a life somewhat of risk. It's just going to be. All right. Now, I don't know what risk you might encounter necessarily. That would be specific to you and your lifestyle. Who knows? But, you know, there's going to be risk involved in the life of the Christ follower, because God is always allowing us to be tested, right, to make sure that our faith, right, grows, so that in the end it can be like precious jewels, metals, etc., not wood, hay, and stubble. Right? So we got to be ready for this thing called risk. And we see that, you know, because life is filled with risk. Now, Nehemiah took a great risk in asking the king for the permission to go. And you know what? The king himself, Artaxerxes, also took a great risk in giving permission to Nehemiah to go back to Jerusalem and begin rebuilding the place. Life is filled with risks. If it weren't, it's a boring life. Are you living a boring life? Kind of like mundane, it's kind of the same thing every day, same old routine. I guarantee you that if you really pull off Nehemiah's prayer principles in your life, you know what, you'll find some risky things will come about. And you know what, your life will get a lot more exciting. Now, it may not all be good stuff, okay, but it's going to get more exciting. Here's the deal. In business, this is true, and you know what? In your personal walk, this is true, I really believe. The more risk you're willing to take, yeah, the more loss you are liable to be subject to, but you have a much greater opportunity for greater gain. You see that? So those who are willing to jump out and take a little bit of a risk and to do some things, you know, that you might not otherwise do, you open yourself to a possibility of great returns. Yeah, you know, you can possibly lose a little bit in the process, but you know what? Your gains out of it can be so much greater. And I believe that that holds for our lives personally as well. And so in Nehemiah chapter 4, you know, what has happened by now, Nehemiah has gone back and they've begun to work on the building. Chapter 3 is all about who did what and what areas were worked on specifically and that kind of thing. And so in chapter 4, we see Nehemiah getting kind of discouraged. But he's not discouraged to the point where he's not willing to try something. There's this guy named Tobiah and Sanballat, you've probably heard of those guys, who were leaders of the anti-Jewish forces there around Jerusalem. And they were really trying to put down the work that Nehemiah and his guys were doing. And so Nehemiah says, "Hear us, O God," here he is praying again, "for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of our builders." So he prays. He said, "God, you know, we got this problem going on, but we're going to keep moving ahead." Which leads us to the final principle of prayer, and that is principle of preparation. The principle of preparation. Stephen Potts told me one time about when he and Nicole were going to a concert. And, you know, he told her the day before that they'd gotten tickets for it. "Honey, I got tickets for the concert," he told her. And she said, "Oh, darling, that's wonderful. Thank you. You know, I love them. You know, I'll start dressing right away." And Stephen said, "That's a good idea, because the tickets are for tomorrow night." We got to do preparation. You know, sometimes we got to start a long time in preparation. What? Oh, it is too. You told me that. Come on. Yeah, come on. You're just because she's here, you're trying to play it down. Come on. So here's the thing, preparation. Not only must we pray, we also must be working the outcome in advance. Does that make sense? You know, God doesn't say, "Okay, I'm going to pray about it. I'm just going to leave it right there." Don't you just love the people? "Well, I've prayed about it. I'm just leaving it in God's hands. Just waiting around." What are you doing about it in order to help bring to pass whatever God might be trying to do? No, just waiting for Him. One phrase comes to my mind when I experience that. It's like, too heavenly minded to be any earthly good. You know? So preparation has a lot to do with part. Here's the other thing about prayer. Prayer is all about partnering with God, okay, to see that the outcome comes out. Now, I'm talking about being selfish about what we specifically want to happen, but to begin working toward a direction. listening to what God says and doing something about it. God told me that somebody's going to da-da-da. Well, I thought, well, could that be you? Since you're the one that's raising the prayer in the first place. Preparation's important. And he says, we rebuilt the wall until all of it reached half its height. The people worked with all their heart. But when those who opposed us heard about the repairs to the walls that had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. And look at what happened in Nehemiah 4, 8, and 9. He said that they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against us. But we prayed to our God and we posted a guard day and night to meet the threat. God, don't let them hurt us. Don't let them threaten us. But Nehemiah also knew that, you know what, a good bet, the part of God's answer to that prayer was that Nehemiah and his people themselves set up a guard. Duh. Does that kind of make sense? Yeah. Common sense calls us to preparation when we pray. You see, a big component of prayer is a readiness to receive what you pray for. And a big part of that is being willing to be an active part of the solution, of the answer. Now, what happens when we embrace Nehemiah's principle? Amazing things happen as we close. On October 2nd, the wall was finally finished, just 52 days after we had begun. Can you imagine that? 52 days. A monumental task had been accomplished. When our enemies and the surrounding nations heard about it, they were frightened and humiliated. They realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. Two things will happen when we embrace Nehemiah's principles. People will be amazed. And number two, God will get the credit. God will get the credit. Isn't that really what we're all about anyway? God getting the credit. That's what we should be all about. Because it's really all that matters. God getting the credit. Nehemiah gave credit for this incredible success to God. And you know what? The enemies were scared to death. Because even they recognized that what had happened was something that could not have occurred through human effort alone. God had done His thing in the life of His people. You know, one of the greatest things we can do if we talk about something like prayer is to practice it. I believe it honors God. And so we're going to give you the opportunity now, and Stephen might give you a couple of instructions here, to practice this as we have some prayer stations set up. And we're going to invite you during the next few moments to take some time, not a lot of time, okay, but to take some time to practice prayer. And I want you to think about some of the things we've talked about this morning as you pray. Not only today, but also in the next week. And to ask God, you know, God, what are the adjustments in my life that I need to bring on board in order to make this a reality in my life? Stephen, can you talk to us and give us some instructions?
Oh, what peace we often forfeit. Oh, what needless pain we bear, the song says. And some of you are going through some stuff this morning. And we want to encourage you just to leave it here this morning and not walk out with it. And we've got some elders that are going to come up right now. And let them pray with you. Come up to this altar and pray. We're going to dim the lights. And we've got some prayer stations over here. We've got some prayer stations over there. If you want to just pray by yourself. But come to this altar. Come to one of these prayer stations. If it's on your heart, and just lay your stuff at the foot of the cross this morning. There is power in the name of Jesus.